most anybody else works. We work on hosts and parasites and cycles and biodiversity and all this other stuff. So, and John's an expert at all this stuff. He's juggled all these things for the last, how old are you now? Almost 70 80. Years.
Almost 80.
Almost 80?
Jesus. Thanks, Scott.
You're welcome.
For reminding me that I'm almost 80. Yeah, okay. I thought what I'd do is sort of pretend we were at Barry's after a couple of beers and talk a little bit about the kinds of conversations that I remember being really the most important and the most thrilling in a lot of ways, in the sense that tended to give you a feeling for the historical nature of your discipline and the ideas that would come out when you start thinking about things like creativity in an area are sort of ideas and ways of viewing your daily activities in a kind of a more global way. So that's what I kind of tried to do this time. So I started with some definitions of creativity and some descriptions of it. And of course, when you start with a definition, you go straight to Webster's Dictionary. Now, to bring into existence or to invest with some kind of a new form. Now, I skipped number 3. I can't remember what it was. And I thought that number 4 was really the most important, to produce something through just simply your pure imagination rather than some kind of a goal-oriented task or a problem that you need to solve. And given the opening slide, I thought I'd go ahead and just pull a picture off of the internet was kind of the rest of the Sistine Chapel. One of the most famous pictures, of course, of creation that had ever been produced was that one that we opened with. However, one of my really favorite, one of the books that has influenced me most throughout my whole life, particularly professional life, is Douglas Hofstadter's Metamagical Themas. And this is a book that sort of explores not only artificial intelligence, but kind of the nature of intelligence within the context of artificial intelligence. In other words, what is it that those people who are working on artificial intelligence are really trying to accomplish? And Hofstadter work deals with that in a lot of different ways. It's sort of a pre-high-end computer narrative, but I would suggest some serious reading of Metamagical Themas. It's one of those that's made my book list and has stayed on there. And I'm going to explore that one just a little bit. In fact, right now, one of my favorite parts of this book, one of my favorite examples of the power of a human mind, an unexplained power of the human mind, is this business of the letter form problem. And Hofstadter picks the letter A and just picks out a bunch of fonts from the old Letraset stuff or whatever that was. This was a set of sheets that you could pull the letters off of and stick them onto a picture of some kind. I remember using those things. This is long before Photoshop, of course. But he just picked out those and said, okay, any native speaker, any person who has grown up speaking one of the Latin languages can recognize all of these A's very easily. So the question that he addresses or tries to address is, what is the essence of A? What is the essence of this figure someone who's grown up in a particular culture recognizes immediately? But this is sort of a really simple example of variations on a theme. He goes then to pluck out a Chinese character, which means black, high, I don't know if I pronounced that correctly, But this is a case where if you're not a native Chinese speaker and have not grown up with the language, the essence of this character is not necessarily obvious. And so he makes that point that when you grow up with a method of communication, then variations on a theme within that method or within that realm are sort of understandable and recognizable in a way that they're not for people outside that realm. And so that's, and Scott, I think, sort of alluded to that in the introduction, in the sense that non-parasitologists are not really in the realm of dealing with the complexity of parasitic relationships. So they don't necessarily understand that one of these is a legitimate vision of a piece of research, and maybe thinking the other one's not, which in fact they both are. In terms of literature, variations in the theme, of course, as soon as you say that to somebody in literature, immediately boy meets girl, which is probably the fundamental theme of literature going all the way back, certainly to the Bible and before. And quite frankly, from reading some of the stuff that's popped up on my internet feeds lately, some familiar fairy tales, and Carl, you may want to comment on this, some familiar fairy tales evidently have long histories that go way, way back beyond their first recorded time. So these may be themes of it. So other themes upon which variations occur all of the time, the hero succeeds against all odds, and that is the movie that's currently up for the most nominations for Academy Awards, namely Revenant. Is that the name of it? Nobody in here? Has anybody seen that?
I haven't seen it, but I've been reading the book.
Yeah, yeah. So this is the hero succeeds against enormous odds, and that's really one more theme. Power corrupts. Have you seen The Big Short? This is a stunning piece of movie making, but it's really about the power that you can exercise financially simply by convincing people that what you have to sell is of value. And so those two, what I would call themes that are pervasive in literature as well as in politics, are currently on the screens in Lincoln. When I think of creativity, I tend to think of two people, and one of them is Picasso and the other one is Mozart, but I also tend to think of Jackson Pollock, and I'm going to talk a little bit about both of those folks. But the Picasso effect I would define as looking at familiar things in very strange and unusual ways, and this is really the whole theme of or underlying idea behind cubism. And we're going to look at people in this room and suddenly rearrange them in some odd way, and then ask, what does that rearrangement actually tell you? So the Picasso effect, I'm going to explore that a little bit in a minute with some life cycles. But here's a perfectly good example, for those of you that are not Picasso aficionados, a picture of a bull and a picture of a woman, from both of them from the late 50s and early 60s. And this, you would almost always recognize a Picasso or a Picasso-like kind of figure, no matter where you find it. The Pollock effect is probably the most creative and the closest to being what you might, when you go back to just a product of the imagination, because he was, of course, one of the main figures in American abstract expressionism. And abstract expressionism, the very term simply means I'm going to express whatever's in my mind, and I don't care really what it looks like, but it's going to be a valid expression. So that's a product almost solely, really, of the imagination. So it's use of existing materials, and in his case, it used floor, used just wall paint and all kinds of sloppy stuff to make, but things that really defy description or explanation. And simply pulled off convergence, but you recognize at least the later Pollocks, you would recognize. Some of the earlier ones are a little more figurative, of course. You'd say, oh, that's a picture of blah, blah. And this one, you just say that's a picture of a bunch of paint thrown on the canvas on the floor, worth several million dollars. Now, so how might some parasitological research then, or maybe I should say areas of parasitological research, be thought of in terms of the qualities of creativity that we just talked about a bit? So I'm going to start with what I think is maybe the most common theme, one of the most common themes in parasitology, and an exceedingly common theme in biology in general, and that is descriptions of new species. So if you just stop a minute and think about all of the taxa in which new species are being described, and then ask yourself, what are the approaches in each of those taxa? What kind of characters do you use? How do you approach it? How do you handle your material? How do you prepare your material? In say new mammals versus new trematodes versus new nematodes versus two insects of any order versus new plants versus new fungi versus new microbes. And each of these then has its own approach, but you end up dealing with relatives. Who are their relatives? What's their phylogenetic positions, their relationships, what kind of physical features do they have, and are those physical features somehow or another meaningful? And in some cases, they are simply not, particularly in the case of bacteria. How big are they? Where do they live? A lifestyle? Are they parasitic? Are they free living? Are they predatory? Are they prey? What? How their development occurs? Is their embryological or their origin, whether it's cell division at the cellular level or viral replication? Are there attraction and mating mechanisms? What kind of impacts do they have on others? Are they competitors or are they predators or are they prey? What are their unique features? You absolutely have to find that in order to describe that new species. What are their features that are common to others in the group? How do they move through the? What are their So this set of words you could in fact apply to characters in a movie. You could refer to characters in a novel. So if you sit down to either analyze a novel or write a novel, then you'll end up dealing with all of this stuff at one point or another, or at least most of it. So I think that I would say variations on the theme of new species descriptions is probably I would think of that as kind of the main or the premier connection between what parasitologists do and some biologists do in general and the concept of creativity. I think they're just simply, you can think of describing that new species in the same way you think of as referring to characters in a novel. I believe, and I really didn't have time to do this, and I didn't have much of a desire to do it, but I know that you can in fact do it, and that would be to simply go into the BioSyst database, and you can easily find examples of variations on the theme of immune reactions, variations on the theme of how do you control a parasitic infection or an epidemic, namely variations on the theme of life cycle development or interruption, killing things you don't like having around. Okay, I mean that in fact is a theme that you can find over and over and over again in parasitological literature. History is baggage, of course, that's the theme of all phylogenetic work, no matter what the area. History is baggage is simply another way of expressing Dan Brook's historical constraints, or if you're a bird, you have a wing because all birds have wings, not because you're talking about plesiomorphic characters. Is really a baggage that you're carrying from a historical point of view. So yeah, we could explore that. Okay, the Picasso effect, looking at familiar things in strange and sometimes disturbing ways. Okay, I don't think any example that I put up is necessarily very disturbing, but again, it simply took one example that is very familiar to me because it happened in our lab, and I happen to have the pictures. Now, this is an example of a very familiar parasitological phenomenon, namely the frog lung fluke. And what you're seeing here then is a sequence of events and a picture that supposed to represent a way that the world works. It's also a paradigm in the sense of being an example of how we should view how the world works. So if we accept this example and sort of concede that the non-parasitologists might have an influence on how we might approach this picture from a research point of view, the first question to try to answer would be, oh, what kind of pathological effect and damage do these worms in the lungs do? So that would be, I think, the very first question that would come out. And the second one would be, what kind of damage do these things do in the snail? They're destroying the ovitestis. Oh my God, that means they're controlling the population. So this is sort of the line of thought the ecologists. However, if you look at Scott Snyder and Matt Bullock's vision of that same phenomenon, what you really see from all of those several papers is frog gape being a major determining factor on which species of frog lung flukes go where and how they get there. You see the extraordinary diversity of potential host-parasite interactions, all of which have their own ecological characteristics as well as their physiological characteristics. So there's not really one life cycle. There are many, 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 many life cycles. So you can multiply the number of frog lung flukes times the number of frog species that are potential times the number of odinate and other non-odinate hosts that are potential transmitters. It just goes on and on and on. So what these guys are really saying, this is almost a Picasso-like look. And if either one of these gentlemen were sitting here at the around the table, they would recognize instantly the meaning of what you're seeing there right there. They would be able to make a meaning of that because they really kind of understand it. And that's exactly an example of looking at something familiar in a strange and unusual and sort of disarticulated and reassembled in a different way practice, and that's essentially the Picasso effect. The Pollock effect is a little more challenging, I think, from the creative point of view, and that's the use of existing materials in the production of things that are essentially defy description. And I think in order to do that, what I really did was go back to Maurice Hall's presidential address in 1932, in which he, and the title of that presidential address is something like, "Is Parasitology a Science?" And that's a question that any of us who call ourselves parasitologists are very familiar with, because we hear it from idiots all the time, people are, some of our colleagues. No, Prestonus. Okay. So if you take it as your object of interest, of course, then what you're really admitting is that your field of interest and your field of science overlaps so many other areas of science, and particularly areas of biology. And every parasitologist kind of knows it. So here's really the issue. It's the overlap sector that I think results in the Pollock effect. And so if you kind of look at it this way, the discipline of parasitology, and this will come out if you read Foundations of Parasitology, especially if you try to write the damn thing, that what you're calling parasitology really takes into account all of these other taxa, as well as all these other sort of processes and procedures, or what you might call realms of ways of observing, or ways of picking up characters. So just to be kind of nasty about it, tried to pick out some colors from Pollock's convergence, and with the idea that each of those colors represents some of the constrained views of some of the other sub-disciplines. In my personal opinion, the ecologists are the most paradigm-constrained people on Earth. During all of those years of doing research at Cedar Point, over and over and over and over again, I heard this question: how do you know the population size of killifish? How do you know that? You don't know the population. Well, it's not important. And so it's really not. And you see the same kind of stuff all the time. So an ecologist will ask questions about what you're doing and ignore all those other colors, just because that's the way they're thinking. That's what they're bringing to the issue of creativity. And so, and the same would be true whether they're immunologists or molecular biologists or what have you. Okay. So the take home, wow, if I'd had more time, I could have pulled out all those other illustrations too. Take home is, once you stepped into parasitology and once you sort of understand what you've gotten yourself into, then your vision is altered pretty much permanently. And it's forced on you by the fact that you're dealing with, as a minimum, the parasite and the host. So no matter what you're talking about in parasitology, you're talking about evolutionary relationships and physiological traits and genetic backgrounds of two organisms, and as a minimum. And if you have a complex life cycle, then you have three. And that condition alone out of parasitology reduces your patience with narrowness. So that's about where I am since Talia came in recently. Let me see if I can. I'll go ahead and just kind of repeat this. This was supposed to be This was supposed to be creativity and parasitological research. Okay. So we defined creativity. We described it as variations on a theme. And we took Hofstadter's letter form problems as an example. We took the letter form problem from another language as a second example to generalize it. We talked about the most pervasive theme in literature and culture of all kind, Boy Meets Girl. But we also talked about two other themes that are the central ones throughout much of literature, but also the central themes of the two big Academy Award nominee movies of this month, okay, that are currently showing in Lincoln. Oops, sorry. Talked about the Picasso effect, looking at familiar things in strange and disturbing ways. Example of the bull and woman. So. And we looked at the Pollock effect, the use of existing materials, the production of stuff that defy description. and pick just one off the wall, convergence is an example. In terms of parasitological research, how could we sort of lay that in? Talked a lot about descriptions of new species and what you have to end up doing, but also this whole activity of or all of the realms of intellectual endeavor and information involved in descriptions of new species could easily be referring to characters in a novel or a film. And here are some other examples of themes in which parasite research can be described really as variations on the theme of parasites elicit a reaction and killing things you don't like to have around, history as baggage. And then we illustrated it, Casso effect, with life cycles. Here's the standard paradigm. Here's what it looks like converted to a Picasso, in which host gape, host diversity of all stages, mechanisms of entry, all of these things really paint the true picture. Here's the Pollock effect. I think this is where it came in. Back to Maurice Hall's. And it's the overlapping sectors that really produce that Pollock effect. And there are the sectors. And here are the paints that are overlapped to produce understanding. And that's the take home. So that's where I am, folks. That's it.
So I think the
questions.
Observations?
Well, it's interesting that you use ecology. I think ecologists, and certainly we kind of have this view that ecology is this massive, multidimensional thing. And then when you actually compare it and realize that ecologists can be like, be the ones that criticize your work for not having all the answers.
Yeah. Well, I think that in many ways, some of the ecological questions, some of the questions that ecologists try to answer are so big and so difficult and so complicated that they just have to pare it down. And I think that some of those, what I would call, I can't even remember the right word, seminal studies, like the Gauss studies on paramecium population dynamics. I mean, that set of studies seems to have such internal, powerful logic and rationality that it's applied everywhere.
Through the years, it became dogmatic.
It's so dogmatic. And, well, going back then to that last bunch of work we did at Cedar Point with modeling of Gregorian parasites in damselflies and working with Dave Logan and trying to put parameter values on all of those population model terms. I finally had to convince him, or we finally convinced ourselves, that some of those terms you could simply ignore. So the first thing those population modelers do is put in birth rate, death rate, and then they do their differential equations. Well, for Gregorian oocysts that live 2 years in a host that lives 10 days or a month, there is no death rate. All there is really the equivalent of a death rate, which is an ecological phenomenon, and they get washed off or separated somehow. So those kinds of things, I think, that's just one example of the ecologists being sort of strangled by their paradigms is maybe a little strong, but choked, I would say. And there would be others too.
So looking at the whole abstraction, how much do you really know about what's going on in that pond? After all these years of poking around,
I could probably. Well, I wrote a book on it, first of all, but
I know. But just take that also.
I would say a legitimate claim about 1/10 of 1%. Yeah.
Enough to write a book on.
Enough to write a book on. 0.1%, yeah.
So, John.
Yeah.
I have a question that I'd rather bring up if we were driving in a van with everybody asleep. But everybody, you and me asleep.
So, I'm not supposed to interrupt people, Carl, but I can tell the rest of the audience that when we were going to swap in a van, caravan, and Carl would ride with me, it was one of the most wonderful experiences of my life. This is a stand-up comic for 12 straight hours in different in different languages and dialects going down, and another stand-up comic for another 12 hours coming back. So, okay, Carl.
There's some serious concepts in that comedy. I always try to convey something serious with my incredible sense of humor. But, okay, John, in the past 3 years, I've been reading a lot of Taoism and Buddhism, and one of the disturbing concepts that's bothered me for these 3 years, but I'm beginning to actually embrace it, is that all the natural world that we discuss as something firm and established is actually kind of a communal perception that has no base in the natural world. Therefore, what we talk about in the natural world is all symbolism that is subject to a creative process. That creative process, before written language, when oral traditions were about, had the ability to be more permutatable, if that's a word. And I guess it seems to me that the core of creativity in science relates to how willing any individual is to expand their mind to accept the fact that creativity and symbolism has to be inherent in how they view the world. What do you think?
I agree with that 100%. I agree with that 100%. However, I'll also say, Carl, that people come into adulthood with different sort of backgrounds. And those people who sort of behave like you've just described naturally tend to be fairly creative in science. And I would say Matthew Bullock is my poster child for that. Absolutely uncontrollable. The first thing he says to me, "Do you mind if I do any little side project?" I don't care, Matt. Just focus on this one general line of research until you get a thesis. And get it before your support runs out. And at that point, he just went. So I think that looking for people who are willing to behave that way is one way to kind of bring into your program some creativity. But I think you also have to have access to the biological material that is manageable. And one of the other truly creative people that I remember, at least in my program, was Pierre Daggett. And this was early on in the 60s and early 70s. He was exactly like that. Totally, not necessarily uncontrollable, but borderline uncontrollable thinker. The guy who would go down to needed a lab coat, so he went down to the fabric shop and bought a big sheet of fake lizard skin and made a lab coat out of fake lizard skin. As you can imagine, Brent Nickel exploded.
So he just got a pattern and learned how to sew and did it?
Oh, yeah. Wow. Yeah. That's a perfectly good example. And if you go back and look at his doctoral work and the publications that came out of it, you can see that creativity in there. Yeah.
Amazing.
Anybody else?
Carl brought up the idea that if you look at the natural world and you have some kind of preconception about, I think that's what he said, about what you're seeing.
Yeah.
So
I suppose that all people have preconceptions about what they're seeing because they have to eat, and they have to mate, and they have to be, keep warm or cold or whatever.
So and it varies. Okay, and perhaps the experience in the Lower Pecos last week, we were collecting archaeological samples, but I spent 2 days with the rock art experts. And what really just astounded me is those rock art panels predict or are my world and their world, but until it had been deciphered for them, by them for me, I did not perceive that. And so again, what I'm saying, Scott, is there are very distinct perceptions of the world that evolved and genetically isolated groups who developed cultural distinctions in part based on where they lived, how they obtained food, how they determined a seasonal round and that sort of thing. But last week was a really big eye-opener.
So what was the rock art interpretation? What was the lesson came out of it?
Let me
go through, we have plenty of time.
Yep.
Let me go through my experience with rock art. Of course, I went to Lower Vegas to think about